Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm Linda P. Jones, your host this week from Be Wealthy and Smart. And I'll be driving the Maserati with Miranda Marquette from Planting Money Seeds. How you doing, Miranda?
I am doing well. I love this Maserati top-down thing that we're doing this week.
Hey, it's better than the bus. Somebody said the bus one week. I'm like, no, we're not on the bus. We're in the Maserati.
Driving across the desert. It's warm and beautiful.
And Joe Salcihi from Stacking Benjamins. How are you, Joe?
Has anybody listened to the show? I think it's a Dodge Dart.
No.
Which is a cool little car.
Takes me back.
But do we all fit into it?
And Doug Goldstein from Goldstein on Gelt. How you doing, Doug?
I'm still driving a Mazda 7-seater because got to stuff the kids in.
All right.
So that's really a sexy car, let me tell you.
All right. Well, we're going to have listener questions today, do a little Q&A, which is really fun. And our first question comes from Daniel. He said, hi, Money Tree people. Great show with getting an expert and then purposely getting different opinions from an informed panel. I have heard on your and other podcasts and books that I need to protect my valuable investments from doom. I am afraid of the limit order placed below the current price, say 15% in case of a flash crash, horror stories abound. And I am leery of paying 2-4%, I've priced it, for making puts down there. Also on my Vanguard ETFs. That will eat into my profit when the crash doesn't happen. I guess the main way is to watch the market, and when my funds go down in a crash greater than 15%, then manually go to cash and use technicals to find a place near the bottom to reinvest. What do you all think? Thanks. How about we'll start with Miranda?
Well, first of all, it's nice that he thinks we're informed. Yay. Thanks, Daniel. So this freaks me out because the idea of if you're in funds, first of all, so if your funds are crashing more than 15% and then you're getting out into cash, you're locking in your crash at 15%. So that scares me just because that is not the way, which is kind of funny because you're like, oh, avoid the doom and everything. And when you're in a down market like that and it's crashing like more than 15%, I know it's weird to say, oh, the scary thing is to get out into cash, but it does. That's scary to me because to me, that's locking in your losses. And unless you're purposely trying to harvest a loss and purposely trying to go for the tax deduction and then get in later, 30 days later so that you don't end up falling afoul of the IRS wash rule, I don't see any point in doing that. If you're in funds and you're confident about your funds, I would ride it out. But that's just me. Let's see what somebody else has to say.
Okay, Doug, what do you have to say?
Yeah, I'm thinking of the client who recently said to me, she said, Doug, watch when the market goes up. And, you know, like if it goes up and up for a few days or a few weeks in a row, then let's invest. And I said, you know, it's exactly the opposite of what we're supposed to do. We should look for when things are going down and down. And that's when you have to get in if you're going to be trying to time the market at all. But I always tell people that I have like zero ability to avoid doom. I did not get any messages or something when those guys flew the planes into the Twin Towers. I didn't know that was going to happen. And I didn't know when the housing bust was about to happen. And I wasn't able to sell everyone out moments before. And I think the answer is that people who are super smart, like the Money Tree podcast panel, if they can't time it, I don't see how anyone could.
Joe, what do you have to say?
I like being smart. No,
they have a pill for that now.
Yes.
Too late.
Continue.
Can we just stop there? You know, I think that when we take a look at any market, there's a chance that the market can go down, and deciding to have downside protection is not a bad thing. But you have to realize that there is no perfect game plan for downside protection, or somebody would have already thought of it, right? So every single strategy you have has an Achilles heel. And I think you have to go in knowing what that Achilles heel is. So the favorite way that I have to play downside protection is what Miranda talked about, which is play the long game, because historically, stocks are not voodoo. They're a reflection of the economy. So if the economy goes up and if you own a diversified collection of stocks, which initially when he wrote, I thought he was talking about individual stocks. But then it turned out when he said Vanguard ETFs, I realized he's already diversified. So if he's diversified and the entire economy's down, and I believe what Doug says about news, and we can never predict that. So trying to figure out technical analysis of the right day to get back in, don't like that. Play long term. The other two ways also have downsides, which is to play stop losses. And he already talked about the downside of that. You have a flash crash, you're going to lose some money. The second one is obviously placing options. I do not like where he ended his letter, which is to manually, quote, watch it. Don't trust yourself to watch the market all day long. You'll drive yourself crazy. That just sounds like a horrible idea to me.
So do you think people should have a red line at all, or just no?
What do you mean should have a line when they say enough's enough?
You know, a guy says, I invested $100,000 is all I got, and if it goes to 60, should I sell, or 50? Like, at what point am I just going to walk away and say, it's just not happening? I mean, should people have a time when they cut bait?
I think that depends.
I'm not a fisherman.
I think that depends more on you and your goals than it depends on the actual market. And it also depends on your ability to sleep at night. I know with most of my clients back in the day when I was an advisor, we would play the long-term game, which was, you know, we're going to stick this out. We don't need the money for 20 years or whatever the amount of money is. And we're going to slowly land the plane before we get to that goal so that we don't have to yank money out. But I had other clients that, you know, they would have a lot of trouble sleeping at night. So we would set stop losses at even as close as 8% or 9%. And what's funny was the psychology of those people once we pulled the money out, because you think differently when the money's out than you do when it's in the market. You think totally different. When you're in the market, you think it's going to go up and up and up. And when you're not in the market, you think, I got to hang on, got to hang on, got to pick the right time. And it's actually more frustrating to be out of the market than in, which surprises people. They think being out of the market with a bunch of cash is power. It is. It's crazy difficult then, because then you have to try to pick the right time, and, you know, studies show you're not going to.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, if you're in funds, the idea of cutting out, unless it's a fund like we've talked about in the past, a very specific sector fund or a very specific fund that deals with something that's not just a broad-based market fund. I don't know. I really think as far as deciding when you're going to cut your losses, it really, like Joe was saying, depends on your personal views. But that's something that you do with individual stocks, not with funds, in my opinion. If you're looking at an individual stock and you're saying, hey, the fundamentals have changed, this is no longer a winner, then you look to cut your losses, and you do so in a way that at least allows you to take a tax deduction.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because Daniel didn't give us his age or what kind of an account this was in. And I wanted to know both those things. I wanted to know, is he someone with a 30-year time horizon or a 40-year time horizon? Or is he someone with a 10-year time horizon? That would be good to know, because the longer his time horizon, the less he should be worrying about this. Secondly, you know, is it a taxable account or is it a retirement account? If it's a taxable account and he's trying to do market timing, he's going to incur a lot of taxes, and that's going to, you know, take away from what he's trying to do as well. You know, he talked about a flash crash. If China devalues the yuan, and, you know, like what happened last fall, it's going to be a flash crash and there's not going to be anything you can do about it. And even a lot of the stops aren't going to work. So you can't really protect against that. So really his best strategy, I think, would be to make sure he's well diversified. And even though he mentioned an ETF, I'm not sure if he's how broadly diversified he is, but I would suggest that he have diversification, stay the course, and listen to my podcast about what to do when the market crashes, because the answer is absolutely nothing. You do nothing. You just stay tuned, stay tight, and hang in there and wait for it to recover. And that's really all that you can do. So,
you know, it's funny, Linda, you talk about what to do. There was an article recently that I was looking at that at first I thought had nothing to do with investing, because it was what professional race car drivers say you should do when you're driving in the rain. And it's amazing, because I initially thought, well, this has nothing to do with anything. And then I realized that this analogy of race car drivers and what they do driving in the rain is a lot like what the average person does versus what a professional does when the market goes down. The average person panics when the market goes down. The professional investor stays the course, number one. And number two, they don't overcorrect, meaning they don't try to make stuff happen that's not there. But the other thing that they do is they do look for ways to take advantage of the rain. I thought that was interesting, to use the fact that the road is slippery to their advantage versus going into panic mode like somebody who's not as comfortable with the rain would do. I found that really interesting and probably a good analogy.
So taking advantage of the rain would be adding more money?
Add more.
And dollar cost averaging when the market's down.
Yeah, find ways to trim your budget so you can save more money. Like, forget about the capital that's there. If you're doing it right, the capital that's there should be in the right place. You shouldn't react to markets if your money is, you know, if I've got 20 years till I need this money, well, then my money's in the right place. So now my goal is when the universe gives me lemons, I want to cut my budget, save as much money as I possibly can, find ways to put just oodles of money into that market to take advantage of the rain.
Good. I like that analogy. That's very cool for our Maserati.
For our bus.
No bus. No, we're not running a bus. Okay, our next letter is from Sunny. Sunny says, love your podcast. As an aside, thank you, Sunny, and we'd love a review from you. He says, I've tried numerous podcasts to keep up with some useful reminders / finger keeping on the pulse of the markets and trends. Have deleted all the other ones except for yours. Hey, that's pretty cool, sort of. Particularly love the at times contrasting viewpoints in the panel discussion at the end. It encourages what you're about to take care about your own finances more than anyone else and to think for yourself. It feels like diets. There are many that will work as long as you have the discipline to find the one for you and then stick to it. A suggestion for an episode: dollar cost averaging. Hey, well, we just mentioned that. What is better, to spread out or to dump in at once when the market is lower like now, or a combination of both, which I do? I have a portion going to cash when I feel the market is positive and overpriced. Then when it starts to take hits, I dollar cost average the remaining cash reserves I've built up into my high growth, leaning 45% on the ASX 300 in Australia. I'm also in it for the long haul. Would love the panel's take on dollar cost averaging. Keep up the awesome work, and thank you for doing what you're doing. Please keep it up. How about we'll start with Joe this time?
Well, it's funny. By the way, thanks, Sunny, for the nice comments, the kind words. The one thing I don't like about what Sunny says here, he says, when the market is lower like now, you have to realize we don't know if the market's low or high. We have no idea where the market's going tomorrow. So people make these assumptions. And when we start making those assumptions, that's when we make mistakes. So here's the deal. Dollar cost averaging feels better. And it certainly is a better idea for most investors because they only have a certain amount of cash flow. But dollar cost averaging of the two ways to invest is worse. If you have a lump sum of money, 70% of the time, historically, the stock market, if that's the way you're headed, goes up. So if we're just playing statistics, you have a 70% chance, if you dump it in today, of doing better than taking that big lump sum of money and putting in it a little at a time. Now, you also have to realize, like I said earlier with Sunny's, you know, the market's low like now. We don't know if the market's low or high. So we're just playing a 70-30 game. But certainly with a long-term time horizon, which is what you should have if you're investing in stocks, yeah, whether you invest now or if the market's 100 points higher or lower, it's so irrelevant.
Yeah, well, just taking into account, this letter might have been written in January, maybe when the market was down, you know, 13% or something. So
yeah,
just to
yeah, but still, even then, you read all those articles, Linda, about how it could go a lot lower. Mm-hmm. We still then don't know if it's low.
Mm-hmm. True. Doug, what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I like the concept of dollar cost averaging, not because I think it actually works. And I saw there's a great online calculator where you can test it yourself at moneychimp.com. You can like put in the amount you want to invest and then compare it with real market figures. And I'm assuming that they have real market figures in there because they say they do, but I can't vouch for it. But you can test. You say, what if I put the money in every month and kept the rest of my cash in the bank, which of course today would earn about 0%. And it turns out that, I mean, unless you happen to to really manipulate the numbers, you're not going to do any better dollar cost averaging than just throwing your money into a properly diversified portfolio. So I think that I'm not a big fan of it. The only time that I would say it really makes sense is when you're telling someone, like Joe said before, just start saving every, you know, all the time. Save as, you know, cut, stop eating and stop, you know, feeding your children and just put all the money into savings because the market is low. If you can do that on a monthly basis, great. So it looks kind of like dollar cost averaging, even though I would just call it saving on a monthly basis.
Okay. Miranda, how about you?
Yeah. So I think dollar cost averaging is really great, as kind of we mentioned a little bit earlier. It's really great when you don't have a lump sum to invest immediately and you're just getting started. One of the great things about dollar cost averaging is that there are places where you can start out with a very small amount of money and you can start investing. Investing $25 a month is better than investing $0 a month. And that's where dollar cost averaging can be of great help. I use it in my own life. I mean, that's what I've got for my retirement account every month. And maybe this goes back to what Doug was saying about, oh, that's just saving every month. But it's the same basic concept. And every month I have the amount of money that goes into my Roth IRA. I have every month my money that goes into the emergency fund that I keep in a taxable investment account. And I have my travel fund. And that all just kind of goes in every month. And it's kind of dollar cost averaged to save up for different goals, because a little bit goes in at a time because I don't have $50,000 to just dump into the market right now. And so I think it's great if you're getting started and if you're working on it. That said, if you have a nice big cash reserve, like our listener, you know, put it all in. Just like Joe said, if you're keeping it in your bank account, just doling it out on occasion, unless you think you're going to need those cash reserves for something in the immediate future, just doling it in, you can do better mathematically speaking by taking that lump sum and just investing it.
Yeah, I'm a fan of him putting it all in as well. He's only 30 years old. He can certainly dollar cost average over time. Him trying to time the market, I think, is a bad idea. I'm not in favor of short-term timing. I do look at cycles and longer-term, bigger moves, but the short-term timing, I think, is a loser's game. And he's got 45% in this ASX 300, which I'm not familiar with. It's an Australian, must be like the Australian S&P. So I would say he's got 90 equities in there, but almost half his portfolio is in that. You know, look at having some mid-cap, some small-cap, some international, maybe some natural resources, since they're also doing extremely well. And just make sure that you're diversified in your portfolio. So that's all that I would add to that. But I like the dollar cost averaging. I think that's certainly appropriate for somebody who's 30. Hang in there and keep doing it. Good job, Sunny. All right. Our next question comes from Chris. Chris says, hey, guys, I've been a listener for over a year now. You do a great job and I've learned a lot. I have two totally unrelated questions, but would be interested to hear your take on both. So the first one is, if I could have an algorithm automatically invest for me every time the market dipped as little as half a point or 1%, would buying every little dip be a good strategy in the long run? If so, why haven't I heard about this? Joe, you have an opinion about that?
Well, the problem is we get into situations like 2000 to 2002, Chris, where you would have had that thing every day and your algorithm would have spent your money in the first 3 weeks and it still would have gone down the toilet. So the difficult thing is the dip stopping. So in the algorithm, it's not about it going down. It's about when it comes back up. So if you're just buying and it going down, if you're in a long-term bear cycle, you're going to invest well before the market hits bottom, I think. I think it needs to be more thought out than that if you're going to build that algorithm. That's why you haven't heard of it.
Okay. Miranda, any opinion?
I've actually heard of people who sell systems similar to this. They have a system that will automatically invest your money in whatever it is they're investing your money in with the little dips. And like Joe said, this sort of system is just, I don't know. To me, it's just begging to rack up your transaction fees and not get a whole lot of value out of it in the end. It seems like, you know, you're like, oh, well, it's just automatic. You might as well just go back to dollar cost averaging, honestly, and just put it in once a month and just deal with that, because you'll have lower transaction fees in the long run.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see if there's any study that's been done on this that has, you know, hard research. But Doug, what do you think?
you know, there are a million different algorithms that people have. And about 20 or 30 years ago, I sat with my brothers who are, I think, brilliant. I'm the good looking one. And we tried to develop some kind of strategy like that. And we spent every night, you know, programming. And in the end, we were able to trade where a little more than half the time our trades were profitable. So we were pretty excited about it. And then the next morning, we woke up and my oldest brother, David, who he's the professor, so he's really the smart one. He said, you know something? I looked at our algorithm and it turned out that our study was just looking at the next day's market close, because we had that information in our database, and was making predictions based on that. And that's when it all of a sudden struck me that there are no systems, you know, and people who think they've developed a great strategy like that, they just probably haven't tested the strategy long enough, or it's really not a great algorithm, because it looks good on paper, but in practice, I'm pretty convinced this idea wouldn't work.
Yeah, and the one thing about backtesting and looking at these models that look backward in time is that the future is never the same as the past. So usually they can, you know, come up with all kinds of theories and this and that, and oftentimes in real practice, they don't pan out. So it'd be interesting to see.
And the other thing you run into is, I mean, I guess you can say, oh, well, this would be like a real-time algorithm that sees it in real time, that sees it drop this small amount, and then all of a sudden you just buy automatically as soon as that happens. Even in real time with this sort of algorithm or this sort of process, there's still going to be a lag. Mm-hmm. Once your algorithm or your program registers the drop, then it still has to say, okay, now we're going to buy and we're going to automatically do this. And then it has to interface with all these different systems. And there's still going to be a little bit of a lag. And by the time everything goes through, you still might have missed out on that little drop just because of the way volatility works.
Mm-hmm. Joe, were you going to add something more?
Yeah, I was, Linda. You know, it's funny when you talk about these ideas that sound good, right? And we have to always beware, no matter what we're listening to, if it's just sound bites. I remember when I first became a financial advisor, there was this guy who talked about this strategy called channeling stocks. And he talked about how stocks trade in a channel. If there's no news, like let's say we take a, pick any company, and it trades in this range between $20 and $30. And they would go back and they would look at this back test. And I thought this was the greatest thing in the world. And I would, you know, put my buy orders in at 20, and then I put my sell orders in at 30. And it never worked. I would go back and I would look for these stocks. Then I went and I started following the company that was talking about channeling stocks, and they were crossing the nation. And maybe some of you guys even know the company that I'm talking about, but they were crossing the nation, selling this strategy to just packed houses full of people. And the only people I ever heard that were getting rich were the people that were selling the system. Right? It's so frustrating to hear these things that sound really sexy, but in truth, aren't.
Yeah. Good point. All right, and question number two of his is, if the United States moved to universal basic income, as some European nations are trying now, what would that look like for our economy, investing, and the markets? Miranda?
Oh, God, don't start with Miranda.
She's like lining up for the check.
Oh, no.
No. So, well, here's the thing is, despite my liberal and socialist leanings, I actually am not a huge fan of the idea of basic universal income. I do like having a social safety net. I do like the idea of having basic services available to those who are struggling and who need a little bit of help. But the idea of universal basic income kind of scares me a little bit. I haven't researched this as much as I should, but and maybe it's just the American in me having a knee-jerk reaction, despite, you know, the fact that I'm a dirty commie. But
deep down, you know it's wrong, right? That's what you're telling me.
Deep down, the idea of basic universal income doesn't sit well with me. You know, like I said, I'm a fan of the social safety net. I just think that having that sort of basic universal income, I think it does kind of dampen, you know, the fire a little bit. It does dampen the idea of getting out there and making more. And it's all complex and mixed up in my feelings of minimum wage. It's all just kind of tumbling together and it's very mixed up and complex and I'm so conflicted right now. But the reality of the situation is I don't think that it is a viable long-term solution for a robust economy. And now somebody else could go into more detail about why it's a horrible idea, because I know you all think it's a horrible idea.
Doug, how about you?
Oh, thank you. I've been like gnawing at the bit. Is that
chomping.
I'm not a horse race. Chomping at the bit. I don't fish. I don't ride horses very well. Yeah, I'm going to have to come out pretty against it. But of course, there are the practical things like it will completely destroy incentive if you give people free money and make them idle and they won't feel any self-worth and they'll be given things that they didn't deserve and then they won't succeed. So it's bad on so many levels, both personally, financially, and just emotionally, to not make people work for something. And of course, the fact that there would be people who are rich who would also benefit from this. And that's kind of silly also. His question really was, what would it look like for the economy? And I think that actually is a very interesting question, because it would seem that if everyone was given this basic universal present from the geniuses in Washington who do everything, with no self-interest whatsoever and all for the good of the people, there will be more money floating around. And that actually would lead to inflation. You know, there was a study I think they did in the UK about when they introduced child tax credits, and they gave people money, for having kids, and they discovered that just as a result of this, the cost of daycare went up because there was more money floating around in that circle, and it caused inflation. So you just multiply that by 350 million people, and I think you'll find that it's one of the worst ideas I can imagine.
Mm-hmm. Joe?
So I like geeking out about this topic. I actually read a thing just recently that was pretty compelling, where economists said the opposite of what Doug just said, that they thought that it actually would work. And I find it interesting. But
tell me their names. Who are they?
I'll kick their butt.
I'm calling them.
That's right.
I'm dying.
No, but you know what? Then I back up, and as a recovering financial advisor and financial media dude now, I think that's my technical term for what I do. You know, this is above our pay grade, number one. Number two is I would meet with clients and they would worry about this stuff. And I think the better thing to do is to worry about the rules the way that they are, not the way that we think they should be or shouldn't be. I think there's a lot of people that get really bent out of shape about things that might or might not happen, and yet their personal financial statement is a house of cards and looks horribly. And if they spent less time worrying about stuff that's out of their control and more things worrying about what's happening in their own pocketbook, they'd get way further ahead. So I mean, that sounds like I'm just an a-hole, doesn't it? I'm just saying, don't ask me that question. But it really, universal basic income, is this going to happen anytime soon?
No. Well, it depends who wins that election coming up.
Well, I just, but
we could get into that if you want, Miranda.
Oh, dear Lord.
But I don't know if it happens, my job, my former job, and even my job now is to deal with what the fallout is of that and how to make sure that you work in that system the best way that you can.
Well, don't forget, Joe, people listening to the show are looking for who the Money Tree podcast panel is going to endorse, because you're right. It doesn't matter how you invest, but it does matter how you vote.
It does.
So what we're saying is, if universal basic income comes into law, we will do a podcast about it.
Works for me, yes.
That's right. That's exactly right. We will do our part at that point.
Well, I just have to add that I think if it did come into law, our taxes would probably go through the roof, and that would not be a good thing for the economy, investing, and the markets. So I'll just leave it at that, Chris. And he says, thanks, guys. Keep up the great work. You're very welcome, and thank you for listening. Our next question is from Thomas Carr. Thomas says, just listen to your March 18th podcast. You guys have been listening too much to union propaganda directed at Walmart. The unions just don't like Walmart because they've never had much success at organizing them. You could just as easily have suggested your listeners boycott Dollar Tree, Family Dollar, Target, Lowe's, Home Depot, etc. Walmart actually has had across-the-board pay increases for workers in the past year or so. That has put them well above many others in the retail sector. In fact, some other retailers have followed Walmart's lead in raising wages. And no, I don't work for Walmart, although I do live in Walmart country. Well, I don't think we need to respond unless someone wants to respond about that.
I just want to say, Costco has been the leader in this field, not Walmart.
Okay.
I mean, if you're going to talk about wages and cost of living and treating your employees right, Costco is the leader in that, not Walmart.
Sorry, they're the leader in doing a good job at it? Or?
Yes, the leader in doing a good job at it. Costco usually pays, for the most part, a living wage, has great benefits, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just want to note that Walmart has closed a lot of stores because of the minimum wage issue. It means a lot of people lost their jobs. But I know we don't want to talk about that, but at least I wanted to get the last word.
I don't remember anybody suggesting boycotting Walmart. I don't even remember this episode in question.
I don't either.
I think I said, Miranda, this was you. You and I were here. Linda and Doug weren't here yet, but we had a big Walmart discussion. I think I was the one that said that I try not to shop at Walmart. So while Thomas might be correct that we could boycott Dollar Tree, Family Dollar, Target, Lowe's, they're not nearly as big as Walmart. And I still think that, and I think the comment he's talking about, I do believe it's a comment that I made, which is that having the federal government subsidize your wages because so many of their employees are on government assistance. Yeah, man, I don't know.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Joe, we were on that podcast.
Oh, were you?
This was not so long ago because I remember you said that. Yeah. I had had enough coffee that
day. Yeah, I think that's what he's responding to. I don't think that's union propaganda. I think that's a fact, but... You know what? I'm generally not on that side of the argument, though. I think, you know, minimum wage discussions are not well thought out by a lot of people.
Is that also not above our pay grade?
It is above our pay grade, which makes me moan because, of course, I get into an area like this that I think is above my pay grade that I shouldn't be commenting on. And Thomas, rightfully so, writes back and wants to tell me where to stick it.
Although I would like to say that I don't shop at the Dollar Tree, Family Dollar, Target, Lowe's, or Home Depot either. So,
where do you shop? Like Bloomingdale's and Neiman Marcus?
Yeah, right. No, right. Most of the time I shop at Amazon.
Which clearly isn't any better.
No. Most of the time, though, I try and shop local. Like if I'm going to go to a home improvement store, I go to a local home improvement store. I get my stuff at a local gardening center when I'm ready to plant my garden. I like to shop at local boutique shops instead of big box stores. But that's just me because I prefer to shop local and support my I believe in local change. You know, I mean, everybody's railing about the presidential election. I'm more interested in my local elections and I'm more interested in my local economy and starting small and starting where I live. So,
yeah, that's awesome, Miranda. That's exactly how people should be voting. People just like you and me should be choosing where we shop, and the government shouldn't be telling us where we have to shop and how much companies have to pay their people. I think people, Joe, you mentioned against boycotting, but if you don't like Walmart, boycott it. That's awesome. That's right. How you really vote. Vote with your feet.
I totally agree with that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Our next question is from Aaron Perez. Actually, it's just a comment. He says, I try not to get into an investment without knowing when to get out. I see many places online describing how to investigate an ETF. Oh, sorry, it's not a comment. It's a question. I see many places online describing how to investigate an ETF to determine if you should invest or not, but I don't see anything on when to get out. How do you determine, one, your exit strategy before you enter, and two, when to get out of if you're already in? How about Doug?
I'm going for the asset allocation model. That would be my approach, which is depending on your financial plan, which I hope you have, and you review, let's say, on, you know, a yearly, at least once every couple of years, you review it. And most likely, as you get older, or as you get inheritances, or you marry someone who's really wealthy, your asset allocation will change. And as a result of that, that'll help you determine when you should sell out of a position like an ETF. ETFs, I'm differentiating as opposed to individual stocks, because ETFs are great tools for long-term investors who just want to get exposure to a certain segment of the market. And that should just be based on your overall financial plan.
Mm-hmm. Joe, what do you have to say about that?
Man, what Doug said, start with the end in mind. You start getting close to that goal within a couple of years of the goal. You have to think about what we refer to as landing the plane. So change your asset allocation as you get closer so that the risk of when you pull it out having so much volatility is lower and lower, right? A plane, as they land, they'll try to decrease their airspeed and they put the flaps up. You want to do the same exact thing. That's the best way of doing it. And I do like, you know, having the exit strategy before you enter. I really like that because I think too many people make investment decisions without thinking about how am I going to get out of this?
Didn't you just contradict yourself? What you said first, the whole financial planning stuff, which I agreed with, and then you said you have to know when you're going to get out. Do you mean like buy the S&P at X and you know you're going to sell it at Y?
No, what I mean is base it on the timing, the time that you're going to get out. So when I talk about timing, I'm talking about, okay, I need this money 30 years from now. So at year number 25, I'm going to begin landing the plane toward that goal.
Got it.
So that is my exit strategy. Follow me? It's not based on the price. It's based on the goal.
Mm-hmm. Miranda?
What they said, and just to kind of add, the only reason that you would need some sort of exit or entrance strategy for an ETF is if you're doing something like cycling with sectors, if you're doing some sort of cycles, sector cycling, if you're doing some sort of resource commodity-based strategy where you're focusing on ETFs that are, you know, investing in gold or investing in something like that, or if you're doing like a currency ETF. Other than that, unless you're doing something like that that requires that you have some sort of entrance or exit strategy, what Joe and Doug said, because ETFs are great for long-term investing, great for broad-based market investing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to echo the same. I would say you want to have your asset allocation model, which is, of course, like a pie, and you're using your large cap, mid cap, small cap, international, maybe some bonds, mid to short term bonds, perhaps, and maybe a 5 to 10% position in different sectors, maybe some real estate REITs as well. So once you've got that model, then you're pretty much just tweaking that until your older ages, as Joe's talking about. And I think that if you're looking at, you know, buying an ETF and then when to sell, I think maybe consider a different strategy. Consider more of an asset allocation strategy rather than looking at an ETF almost like it's a stock, which kind of sounds like maybe what you're doing, Aaron. Good question. Okay, next is from an anonymous listener.
Uh-oh.
This is the comment. I listened to my first episode today. I really want to like this, but I couldn't make it through. The 21-year-old that asked about leveraged ETFs was directed to basically buy the SPY index, even though he just wanted a little bit more risk than that. Why not direct him towards a real estate trust like BX? I felt like you guys left him hanging. Then making fun of that woman who misunderstood the money tree. Don't make fun of your audience, no matter how foolish they are, but you all just went off on her. Regardless, I'll give this another shot. You sound like smart people. Well, anonymous listener, I don't know if I was on the show then. I hope I wasn't, because we take our audience seriously and we don't want to make fun of them. So if we did, I apologize if I was a part of that, but I don't know. What do you guys think about this? Does anyone remember this?
I don't remember a 21-year-old asking about leveraged ETFs.
I think I remember the discussion about that. And sorry, I just want to double with Linda. If we did offend anyone, I certainly do apologize. I think that it's not that we were directing him towards an S&P index. It's that we didn't actually think, based on his letter, that his idea for investing in a leveraged ETF was a good idea. So we were sharing our thoughts. And certainly a real estate trust like BX is totally something different. So why would we have directed him when he was talking about one thing into something, you know, completely different?
But I do remember the money tree, and it is funny because, and I still think it's funny, I'm sorry, anonymous person, because I don't think it was a podcast listener. I think it's somebody that went to our website, saw a money tree, and asked, how do I invest in a money tree? And I also want to invest in a money tree. But when you go to a podcast website and ask about investing in a money tree, I still think it's hilarious.
I think that she thought we were an investment scheme.
Right.
I think that's what we were talking about, is she misunderstood and thought we were an investment scheme. Well, like Joe, sorry, not sorry.
I still think it's funny. Can I invest in a money tree?
Like a cash cow. Joe wants to buy a cash
cow. Absolutely.
Joe and I are terrible people. And if you don't want to listen to terrible people, then you should probably go someplace else, because Joe and I are terrible people.
Yeah, but I don't think, but we're not making fun of our listener.
We're not making fun of her. We're making fun of the idea of a money tree. Because
Do you think that person really listened to the show? I don't think that's a person who listened to the show. I think that somebody went to our contact form, saw that it was a money tree website, and asked, how the heck do I get in on the money tree? I mean, that's all I think happened. If they listened to the show, they'd know immediately that it is. I mean, look at how smart these other letters are that we have. Fantastic letters from great listeners. But investing in the money tree, come on. That's hilarious.
You know what's funny is people in the financial world, we know what it takes to grow money, and we're like the last ones to want to gamble or do something like that, like go to the casino, right? So
I love going to the casino, but I do it with my fun money.
Yeah, or, you know, pay the, I don't know, the small slots or whatever. But anyway, a money tree, the whole idea of a money tree would be like, yeah, that would be great if it existed.
Yeah, to me, it's the same idea as the prince giving me the money, you know, the prince from Africa who writes me every month telling me that they're leaving me a sum of money.
Exactly.
I'm pretty geeked about that.
You haven't claimed yours?
I'm pretty upset that hasn't come yet.
Dude, I got $85 million.
You do realize that we're doing it again, right? We're making fun of somebody, right?
I don't.
No, not of her, just the money tree.
But we're not. I'm defending my sense of humor.
We're making fun of the money tree, not of her.
Yeah.
I thought mostly we make fun of Joe here. That's kind of what I thought the show was about.
We try.
That is the true theme.
It's not like we don't make fun of lots of things.
Yeah.
Let's move on to Charlie, who said, "Hi there. After listening to your program for over a year now, thank you, Charlie, I'm becoming more and more interested in trying to become a CFP. My plan is to continue working at my current job while studying through Dalton online classes, passing the exam and becoming registered with my state, and then starting out trying to attract clients part-time and do financial planning on the side. I've been reading a lot about the series tests, meaning 6 and 7, etc., and was wondering which I should take if I would like to make stock recommendations to future clients. My plan as of right now is to take the Series 65 because I would like to make recommendations but not manage their money myself directly. What are your suggestions? Thoughts on becoming a CFP? Am I going about this the wrong way? If there were one thing you would tell someone starting their own personal finance investing blog or podcast, what advice would you give them knowing what you know now?" Who wants to start with that one?
Somebody who is a CFP, perhaps.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, so here you go. First of all, I'm wondering, should we edit out your full name? Because, like, depending what you're doing, your boss might not be happy that you're, you know, planning to leave. But I'll leave that up to our engineer. So my first thought is, doing it on the side is not. I'm studying and learning about it is great, but the tests to become a CFP are really hard. There's a lot you have to know, and there's a huge amount of studying. So great to do it on, you know, nights and weekends, but just be aware you're getting involved in several years of studying pretty serious stuff. And I think if you want the one bit of advice that I would bring up is ask yourself, how will you get clients? Because that is one of the hardest parts of the business is how do you get a business going? And I've been doing this now for decades, so it kind of runs itself. But I can remember when I started, wow, I spent most of my time just trying to figure out ways of finding people who would actually want to hear what I had to say, rather than thinking of brilliant things to say, which is what I get to do now on the Money Tree podcast.
Joe, as a recovering financial advisor, what advice do you have?
Yeah, I'm with Doug. It is about finding clients. It's not about having great advice. I remember when I started with a big firm, there was a guy who had all kinds of credentials and he started and he couldn't stop complaining his first year about that it was a marketing job, that he was actually expected to market instead of being handed accounts. And our manager, I remember, said what I still think was the truth. He's like, "You're the brand new guy. You think we're giving you the Glengarry clients?" If anybody knows that reference.
Yep.
So
Ross King.
Yeah. So we're not giving you the best stuff. You're brand spanking new. And it is a marketing job. And what's funny is in your first year, you also had to make a lot of decisions that are not comfortable decisions, but like another manager of mine said, the key for my clients, my initial clients, was to make sure I stayed in business. If I stayed in business, I could advise them long term. If I didn't stay in business, I would not be able to advise them long term. And that becomes that gets into a whole longer. I mean, I could talk about this for forever. I'm sure Doug probably could too. But I think when it comes to training, getting involved, I like the fact that he's going to do it part-time because then he can dip his foot into the water. I also think that, though, he should probably try to find a mentor and somebody who knows what it's like in the trench, because it's not about great financial advice. If you're going to succeed, it's also about systems of delivering that advice. And I know I've been talking for a little while, but there's a good analogy here. I was watching one of those kitchen shows, the one with Gordon Ramsay, the dude who screams a lot. And he was in somebody's kitchen, and these people cooked like people cook at home. And he pointed out to them that when you work in a commercial kitchen, you can't cook with all those tons and tons of ingredients. He's like, you're creating beautiful food, but nothing's ever coming out to the people trying to buy it. Nothing, because it takes too long. The key with a commercial kitchen is how to create food that tastes better using very simple strategies and systems that you can replicate over and over, so they'd rather eat at your restaurant than they would eat at home. And that's kind of what you got to be when you're a financial advisor. How can you serve, you know, I served 150 families. How can you serve 150 families and make families feel like you're there all the time? That's not something you're going to get without finding some mentorship.
I love that you guys are talking about, you know, hey, focus on the business and you got to grow your business and don't worry about the advice, because as somebody with absolutely no credentials, I give advice all day long on my blog. And yeah.
Well, but that's where your credentials,
but once again, you know, it is free advice, so you get what you pay for.
Yeah, but Miranda, you've been in the trenches long enough with the advice portion that that's not the issue. I think there's a lot of people out there that can give at least fair advice. And I've read your blog and it's way above that. But that's not becoming a financial advisor. And I think that's where people get into trouble, is they think that's the hardest part. What Doug said is the hardest part.
Right. And kind of along with that, one of the things that I realized as I was doing a lot of ghostwriting work for financial planners, writing their books, writing blog posts for them, writing op-eds for the Wall Street Journal, one of the things that I realized was that depending on whether you associate with a specific type of business or specific financial planning network, there are things you can and cannot say. As a financial planner, there are restrictions on what you are allowed to say on your blog. And so that's something to think about as well. If you think you're going to get out there and use your blog as a marketing tool, which it really is. We know of people like Jeff Rose, who grew his practice quite a bit just through his blog. And being able to do that, you have to be aware of some of the restrictions that come with that credential. So even though I may not be credentialed, I have fewer restrictions on what I can say and how I can comport myself.
Well, that's very true. And I don't often disclose this, but I've been a CFP for decades, like Doug, and started early in my career because I wanted to know everything about money and investing and retirement plans and estate planning. And there's no education out there that's better than a CFP if you want to learn all of that. If you're just interested in making stock recommendations, you don't need to go that route. But also just understand that it is rigorous. It's going to take a lot of time. And there were many people who started and never finished because it does take a big commitment. So I would just say, you know, take the advice of Doug and Joe that it is about how many assets under management you have and about gathering clients, and that's going to be a big part of your focus. So just really understand what the role of a financial advisor is and what the pros and cons and the frustrations are that financial advisors deal with. It's not just about making stock recommendations to future clients. So. But good for you that you have an interest in that, and good that we have fueled that for you. That's pretty cool. So our next question is from Krista. She says, Dear Money Tree, I've recently started listening to your podcast. I find it extremely useful for someone like me who is just now getting into investing and am trying to learn as much as possible. I have a question for you all. I'm 27 years old and recently inherited some money, something for which I am grateful for every day, and I want to invest it wisely by putting a portion of it, maybe $100,000 to $200,000, into stocks, probably in a couple of index funds and ETFs. I know the benefits of dollar cost averaging, but with a large sum to invest, I'm not sure what the best strategy is. Because of my age, I can probably afford to take some more risk, and I've set aside a portion for an emergency fund, and I also have an okay income. I'm struggling with how to get started in the stock market with such a large amount. Should I invest it at once or in parts over the course of some months/years? What advice can you offer people like me who suddenly inherit a large amount of money? Thank you. Well, we'll start with Mr. Financial Advisor Doug.
All right. The question of getting an inheritance, I think, obviously you have the right outlook, but I just want to share with all the listeners, which is that a lot of times when people get an inheritance, they feel kind of guilty and they feel like, oh, I better, you know, I got it from my father and he had it all in stocks, or he loved, you know, this stock and that's how he made his millions. So I better keep doing that. But it sounds to me like you're not saying that, which is great. So just make sure to realize that you don't have an obligation to continue along exactly the same investment path that the person who left you the money was doing. That's one. The second thing I would just keep in mind is if you have any big debts, and I know we've discussed mortgages and the like, but if you have things like evil debt, like credit card debt, just get rid of that. Take this as an opportunity to start from zero and promise never to get into that kind of debt again. And finally, I would go with the start slowly. It's not that it on paper, it might be a really good idea to set up a great asset allocation model, put all the money into ETFs or funds or stocks or mutual or whatever it is you're going to do. And, you know, on paper, that'll look good. But you're a real person, and this sounds to me like it's your first time doing it. Put a little bit of money into the market. See how you feel when it goes down. Hopefully for you, the moment after you invest, the market will crash and you'll go, oh my God. And you'll learn a huge amount about yourself and whether you can actually handle that kind of volatility. And then slowly build up into the market until you're fully invested.
Joe?
Well, and that's the key. I love what Doug says, because that advice is spot on, and because it's not about the markets, it's about you. And handling that much money is such a mind shift that I love that. Yeah, I like buckets, because that's going to solve a lot of your investing issues. Instead of focusing on, well, I think I might use some index funds, I would say, okay, what do I want this money available for? And hear that correctly. It doesn't have to be this money is for a house 10 years from now. I want this money available for a house 10 years from now, because then the investments in that time frame pick themselves. So instead of having to worry about the whole spectrum of investments, now you look at investments that have historically done well over that time frame, and that creates your asset allocation, as we call it. That's how you pick the investments. Plus, it also tells you what tax strategy you can use. Because whenever you think about the goal, then you can say, okay, is there a tax shelter available? Like as an example, if it's going to be for somebody's college, well, then you could look at a 529 plan if you're fairly certain that it's going to be for college. If it's going to be for money that you need after 60, well, then you can use it, you know, in tax advantage ways that way. But having the right tax shelter and having an investment that drives the engine of your Maserati. How about that, Linda? That's what I think I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm. Miranda?
Ditto to Doug and Joe. And I think one of the most important things you seem to already have the handle on is whenever you receive a large windfall, the best thing to do is do nothing with it for a few months so that you can wrap your head around it. What are the big problems that many people run into when they receive an inheritance or lotto winnings or some sort of huge windfall like that is it feels like you can just spend the money. It feels like you're never going to run out. It feels like it's there to be spent. Or you say, oh, well, I have enough money that I could put it into this amazing investment opportunity that my buddy just told me about. None of these are good ideas, and you really do want to sit down, sit back, and take stock of the situation and get a little bit more information on how you want your money to perform for you. And just like Joe and Doug said, figure out your goals, figure out what you want the money to accomplish for you and when you want that when you need it available, and then you can start planning around that. But kudos to you for sitting back and saying, hey, instead of just spending this or just dumping this into the first investment that catches my eye, let me think about it. And that's the way to start.
Well, I agree with all three of you, and I want to also congratulate her for being an investor, because most inheritances are spent within 5 years, and all that money is gone within 5 years. So it's very good to invest. I think you should get a team. I think you should organize a financial advisor and an accountant and put together a team of advisors who can help you, because what you don't want to do is you don't want to practice with that money. You don't want to start investing when you have no experience investing. If you don't, you don't want to, you know, practice with that. So you want to go to a professional who can help you and get it invested the right way.
Doug's looking for new clients, right?
If you have any questions, thank you. Feel free to contact me at Doug@profile-financial.com. Thank you.
There we go. Cool. Well, that is all of our listener questions. We made it through.
Already?
This Maserati's taking one more swing around the block and going into the garage. So, Miranda, what do you have to say to our listeners?
Hey, make sure to check us out at moneytreepodcast.com and subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher. And don't forget to leave us a review. Tell us how terrible we are and how our advice sucks, or tell us how we've helped you in your life. We love to hear that kind of stuff. And remember that no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.